Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning. It's nice to see a full hall. It's been a while. And nice to see we have people online too, Ray Lynn.
Yes, 104.
So we have a full in-house and online house this morning. Thank you for giving up weekends for many people are their free time. So thank you for giving up so-called free time, hopefully to do something that you feel is meaningful and that will contribute to the rest of your life. Again, we want, it's interesting, free time sort of implies unscheduled time, right? Free from scheduled time. But freedom and being free is sort of central to Buddhist practice. But it's a different kind of freedom. It means to be free of suffering, free of neuroses, free of stress, free of self-centeredness. Free of all the impediments that really get in the way of us really living, you know, the life we want to lead and relating to people in the way we want to be. We all have, I think most human beings, many human beings have good hearts. At their best, they have good intentions for themselves and for others, and maybe even for the world. But unfortunately, because of stuff that they're not free of, their capacity to live in the way they want, relate in the way they want, gets compromised, distorted, sabotaged. So that's why we practice. This weekend has been a busy weekend. I'm going to talk a little bit today. We have this Dharma Transmission Program. It's a three-year program. There are 13 members in it. It's our second one. I guess six, 7 years ago, there was another program. Had about 15 people in it. I'll talk a little bit about that today, and also want I've asked three of the members who are participants, this is their third year, end of their third year, to talk about their experiences, just their own personal experiences from being in the, from being going through this process of study and practice for 3 years. But just for a few minutes before then, I've had a lot of fun. Most people probably wouldn't consider it fun. But there's this book, Three Pillars of Zen. I don't know if anybody knows it, but this was the book that in 1968 got me going into Buddhism and Zen, written by Roshi Philip Kaplow, who was my first teacher. And I actually lived in Rochester at his center and with him from about 1968 to 75. And this was our Bible. It was the back then when there was hardly anything around. There were books about Buddhism. They were all poorly translated, and everything else was mostly intellectual or philosophical. Kind of that Zen, let's say, was actually something you did rather than something you talked about. And that the freedom that people love to read about with the anecdotes of the Zen teachers was actually something that one could experience. It wasn't just something to talk about at cocktail parties. Was kind of mind-blowing for some of us. So this is a very practical book. It's a how-to book. about meditation and Zen, and had interviews of what goes on in interviews between teachers and students. It had half a dozen first-person accounts of people who had had, you know, what are called Kensho experiences, insight into the nature of their mind experiences, modern people, you know, not ancients, but people of today, you know, people like us, housewives and business people and parents, and, you know, so it was a game changer, and that really what got me going. So you know, a lot of wisdom in it, you know, but I say I probably haven't opened it up in 30 or 40 years. God, dates me. So I left there in 1975. So that's 45 years ago. That's what happens as you get older, you know, when you remember things, you have to add on a few decades. No, that wasn't 25 years ago. So, in his introduction, this is Kaplow's introduction to this section by one of his teacher, Yasutani Roshi, who did these kind of introductory lectures on Zen practice and Zazen and the basic teaching. So in Kaplow's introduction, he writes, that a strong sense of moral responsibility is inherent in the spiritual freedom of the awakened person was made clear by Yasutani Roshi in response to a question addressed to him in America. This is so Yasutani, this is back in the 50s, Yasutani traveled a little bit in the country, and there were small little groups of Zen practitioners. So somebody asked him if, as beat Zen, this really dates me, and they remember the things called beatniks? There used to be things called beatniks. Remember there were hippies? People know about hippies. So before there were hippies, back in the 50s and 40s, there were these alternative people called beatniks. And the beatniks, because they liked the freedom, you know, they'd read these Zen stories and all the freedom of these Zen characters, you know, they liked that because they wanted to be free of all restraints. So people asked, if as beat Zen, B-E-A-T, has led us to believe, awakening reveals the unreality of past and future, isn't one therefore free to live as one likes here and now without reference to the past and without thought of the future? Sounds like a good question, right? But what he's getting at is the people who are asking that were really going, so therefore, I can do whatever I want. There's no past, there's no future, it's all just fabricated, there's only the now. So, you know, can't I just totally lead a hedonistic, indulgent life and do whatever I want because there's no past or future? So that was kind of beat Zen, you see. And so now beat Zen beats a real Zen master, right, who they had never met, right? So this is interesting. In reply, Yasutani Roshi, he was a professor. He was not only a Zen master, but he was a professor. And he taught Buddhism. I think at a Buddhist university. I think in Japan there are universities that are kind of Buddhist run, but they have a full course load, but I guess they have a lot more Buddhist courses. In reply, Yasutani Roshi made a dot on the blackboard and explained that this isolated dot represented their conception of the here and now. So this is very important, because I think even though this is going back into the 50s, I think it's very true for today, really deals with the whole world of I was about to say secular mindfulness, you know, which is very popular. But I think even for a lot of people who practice in various Buddhist traditions and believe that they are practicing correctly and mindfully, that living in the present is that dot, right? Okay. Is that dot one dot, see the dot, isn't that the present moment, right? Right. Dot. Teacup. See teacup. Dot. Tasting. Dot, right? So for most people, living in the present moment, right, living in the here and now, means that I am present to whatever I'm doing, right, whatever I'm experiencing. Does that make sense? I mean, I think that's sort of the way it's defined, and that's what most people would say it is. Dot. To show the incompleteness of this view, Yasutani Roshi then placed another dot on the board, right? Competitive dots. And now he drew a horizontal line through it and a vertical one. So here's the dot, but there's a horizontal line that starts at the furthest end of the blackboard and goes all the way across the blackboard, intersects with the dot and goes all the way to the end. And then there's another line that starts all the way at the top, comes down, intersects with that dot down to the bottom of the blackboard. He then explained that the horizontal line stood for time from beginningless past to the endless future, and the vertical for limitless space. The quote-unquote present moment of the enlightened person stands at the intersection, embraces all these dimensions of time and space accordingly. This is very significant. Is that clear? Now, for someone who doesn't even know there is a dot to attend to, attending to the dot, attending to that which is right in front of them, attending to the person who is speaking to them, attending to whatever mind state is arising in them, or thoughts, or, you know what I'm saying? Being present to one's life, walking, drinking tea, right? Living is very helpful. Is that true? Very helpful. It reveals something too, especially people like us in our, you know, we have minds that are going all the time, and our minds are always being stimulated, who live so much in conceptualization and thought, right? To have the capacity to slow that process down and just to attend what's going on right in front of oneself, right, is incredibly beneficial, right? And it feels good. And it allows one to be present to whatever's going on in one's life in a very direct way, right? Just to be able to be present to whatever is arising. So great benefits come from just being present to the dot, just being mindful. Is that clear? Now, the other thing I was going to read to you was something he, in another one of the lecture, he talks about levels of Zen. And again, and this is ancient teaching. In Japan, they call the first level of Zen, and Zen just means sort of meditation. So Zen is a shortening of the word Zazen that comes from the word Chana, which is Chinese, that comes from the Sanskrit Dhyana. Dhyana is one of the six paramitas, and it's part of the path. Dhyana just simply means single-pointed concentration, absorption, meditation. So so the first level of Zen, meaning really the first level of meditation, or the usefulness of meditation, is what they call Bumpu Zen, which is really what we might call I would say, secular mindfulness today. It means it is therapeutic. It is helping us to slow down, to stabilize, to be present to thoughts and feelings, to make changes, right? I mean, I think you all know that. But it's not Zen Buddhism. It's just Zen. It's taking the meditative piece out and saying it can be applied in all kinds of ways that are beneficial to everyone. Right? There's another level of Zen, I forget the Japanese, the next level, where you're practicing Zen for more specific kind, you're practicing meditation for more specific reasons. And a lot of that has to do with what they call in Japanese, juriki. You're developing energy like chi. So this could be, I'm practicing Zen because I'm in the martial arts. I'm practicing Zen because I'm in the healing arts. You know what I mean? I want to, you know, learn how to meditate to channel my energies. You know, they can be, you know, one can meditate because one wants to space out, or one wants to see things, or one wants to have visualizations, or have visions, or you see what I'm saying? So there are all kinds of sort of applications that are more than just therapeutic of meditation. But that's still not Zen Buddhism, right? I will get back to the intersection of the two lines. The next levels, and I'll just talk about them, are where you combine Zen, the meditation, with Buddhism. Again, the Buddha said, I teach one thing, I teach the cessation of suffering, right? So to practice Buddhism, and again, there are many, many practices, paths and all that, is because one is no longer having a limited use of meditation, right? Either simply for therapeutic basis or for a kind of energy basis or power basis or anything. You know, one is using it as part of a path of transformation. Okay? You know, one would say more of a spiritual or religious path. So when one is practicing, you know, meditation is still key, but the use is broader. Now, the what they call the small level of practice of meditation is for someone who suffers, and we all suffer to one degree or another. You know, some people suffer a lot in this life. Some people don't suffer much in this life. We all have different karmas, but everybody suffers, right? Even if things are good, we still suffer the change of getting sick. We still suffer the change of growing old. We still suffer the change of death and seeing everybody else around us. I mean, we still suffer impermanence. We still suffer from not getting what we want and getting what we don't want. We still suffer from losing what, you know, gain and loss. So we all, you know, and we suffer from just a deep, often feeling, even when everything is wonderful, that somehow it's separate. We feel separate, we feel alone, there's something disconnected. So so this next level of person, they see all this, right? Ooh, this. And so they go saying, they say to themselves, what? I want out. I want out. I'm sick of this. So it's called Hinayana, meaning small vehicle, because they're only thinking of themselves. And often what these people do is they use meditation to escape. And so often they practice meditations that put themselves in an altered state. And there are many spiritual paths where going into trance states is the goal. Because in those trance states they escape from, right? This world that they perceive is a world of suffering. For a time, they escape from the boundaries of self and self-centeredness, okay? But we don't stop there. So that's the small vehicle. The great vehicle, the Mahayana, which is what we practice, again, and meditation is still central to our practice, is when we look around the world and we see suffering, when we look around inside and we see suffering, we realize everybody's suffering. We're all in this together. It's not just me. It's my family, my parents, my loved ones, my friends, my colleagues, my, you know, I see everybody to one degree or another is participating in this world. And so therefore, the object of my spiritual practice is not to leave it, either geographically leave it by, who wants anything to do with this world, or in their meditation by kind of trancing out. Right? Escaping. Many people, you know, escape from. No, in Mahayana Buddhism, we want to awaken in the world. And we realize it is perception that is everything. And that actually there are many wonderful things in this world. And this world has a great capacity for transformation. But the significant problem with people is they are ignorant. I mean, we see they have all these problems and all these issues and all this violence and all this intolerance and all these biases and all this, you know, all the ill. But that's like the flowering of a fundamental ignorance that's within every human being, that they don't experience their interconnection with everybody. They don't experience their interbeing as an experience, right? They feel separate. When you feel separate, when I am not you, then you are somebody that I can use to meet my needs. Or you are somebody who's getting in my way, or you're somebody who I don't want in this world, you see, because you see the other as separate from you. But when you no longer see anyone as separate from you, you act in a different way. So in Mahayana Buddhism, we find teachings and practices where compassion and loving kindness and caring for the suffering of others and self, you know, in the Hinayana, it's like just having the meditative experience of seeing non-self. That's the key thing. In Mahayana, that's there, but the key thing is then living a selfless life. A life that is not conditioned by me, but a life that is conditioned by, you know, being there for others, taking care of others, concerned about others. It's a very different life, as well as this teaching of emptiness. We don't need to get into it today, that all things are inherently empty of any solidity, which means, and that everything is impermanent, which means all the things of the world do not have to be rejected. See, in the Hinayana, it's like, ooh, you know, you start getting things and you get a house and you get a mortgage and then you're trapped and you know what I mean? And then you get greedier and greedier. You want more things and ooh, you know what I mean? And God, relationships, attachment, aversion, suffering, ugh, you know, right? Renunciation. In Mahayana, that's not the path. The path is, oh, I see, I can see clearly how everything is. Everything is Nothing has any solidity. Everything is in process. Everybody is just a product of their causes and conditions. You know, I can act wisely, intelligently, compassionately in the world and not, you know, I'm not attached. I don't grasp. So the world is no longer something to be rejected. It's just not something to be grasped at and held on to. One develops an enlightened view. Okay. What does this have to do with the blackboard? Somebody might be going, gee, Fred's all over the place this morning. So the first thought is what? The here and now of the ordinary unenlightened person. It's me, I'm here, and I'm pouring tea. The second one, the awakened person, this moment has no beginning or end. This moment is unfolding in timelessness. This moment is unfolding in spaciousness. This moment has no solidity to it at all. And everything that's appearing in it has no solidity. I know right now we all look very real to one another, but science would tell us that that's an illusion, right? Nothing here is solid, nothing here is permanent. Our bodies, this moment, changing second to second. So this realizing that in our practice, our mindful living path, we start noticing the dot, that there is a here and now, there is a present moment. But then the practice is to deepen, to realize that in this present moment, all moments are present. And in me and you, all beings are present, is what he was getting at, right? That's the real, ultimately the goal of practice. So, I thought I'd share that with you. So we have this is our second Dharma transmission program. Let me just quickly tell you about it. It's 3 years. It is not it's not like a Dharma teacher's training program. It's really something that I wanted to do years ago, which was take a small group of people who are committed to transmit in a very systematic way. I mean, we have lots of retreats here. We have lots of talks. We have lots of intensives and workshops, but in a very systematic way, beginning to end kind of way, sort of present, you know, at least the Dharma as I understand it. So we have the 3-year transmission program. It is open to members. We open it once every third or fourth year. The only major criteria is they have to be members for a certain amount of years and they have to be under 60. People who are over 60 do not like that. But again, it's kind of selfishly, I want to invest for our community and having groups of people who, you know, who will be around a while. And you know, statistically, the older you get, the less chance that you'll be around in the future, including myself. But there are a lot of commitments. I mean, people are committing to 2 hours of study and practice every day. They're broken up into small groups that I meet with every other week. I meet with each of them in individual meetings once a month. We hold colloquiums once a month for everybody. They do 4 weekend retreats a year. We're having one of them this weekend. And they commit to 5 to 7 day solitary retreat every year. And again, most of these people are people with families or jobs. So as you can imagine, it's a serious commitment, but yet something that can be done. But it takes kind of paring away at one's activities, and also obviously takes the full support of partner, family, whatever, to do it. And unfortunately, we have people to do it. Done it. And during the course of these 3 years, they really get a breath. I mean, the first year, it's what, it's original Buddhism. It's all the, you know, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the three of this and the four of that. You know, all the basic fundamental teachings of Buddhism are really studied intently. There are lots of books, there's a curriculum. It's sort of like university, as well as, you know, they have a commitment for an hour of meditation every day. So it's like university plus practice. Second year, we do the Mahayana, a lot of focus there, obviously, on some of you, many of you know, The Way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva. It's a wonderful text, plus we put another text. And this third year is the wisdom part of the year. So we're doing Zen, that's how we're doing now. We're doing a whole section on Zen and Chan, which is Zen, as it originally was called in China and still a very active tradition in Korea. And before that, we did a whole section with the Tibetan wisdom traditions, Vajrayana wisdom traditions. So that's what we're up to. So that's kind of the program, but I wanted you to hear from three of your Sangha brothers and sisters who've been in the program, just their experience. I've asked them not to talk about anything that I just talked about, but just to share with you so you get a sense what it's been like for them. Two are online, right? Oh, in here we'll only be able to hear them. So Donna and Chris and Rosie, where's Rosie? Here's Rosie, and Rosie will be in the hall. So why don't we let somebody go from online, then somebody in the hall. Why don't you sit up here, Rosie? So why don't we go, let's go with Donna. Donna lives in near Asheville. She was in North Carolina. So a lot of her contact is online, but she does come down for retreats and she does come down for solitary retreat. She's a therapist. So. Donna, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I'm unmuted.
Thank you. We can hear you.
Oh, great. Hi, everybody. I am really grateful to share with you today. I was telling Fred the other day that the Dharma Transmission Program has been just the highlight of my life. What can you say about something so important? And I think, you know, as I look back on it, he asked me to share a little bit about my practice before and my background in Buddhism. I started practicing, or at least looking into it, 20 years ago, and started with a miracle of mindfulness, like a lot of us did. Suzuki, Zen mind, beginner's mind, you know, just exploring all of those things. I was also studying yoga, sutras, Yogananda, and Self-Realization Fellowship. I did that for a couple of years. Read A Course in Miracles. And A Course in Miracles, if you don't know it, is very non-dualistic. So someone told me one time, if you want to study A Course in Miracles, then study Buddhism. So after reading A Course in Miracles, I really, you know, my compassion and bodhicitta just went wide open. And I also had these really unique kind of experiences for me. But I think overall, I just decided I'm going to change my life. So I went back to school, I became a therapist, but I was still like, what do I do in this Buddhism realm? So I started to go to Spirit Rock to retreats, had a retreat with Jack Kornfield, who I really appreciate, a Goenka retreat. I went to Magnolia Grove for one day, which was really sweet to see Thich Nhat Hanh. But Southern Dharma, I wound up there and went to several retreats. So by the time I met Fred in 2017, I had probably been to a dozen or so retreats. And the first night with Fred at this Unfettering the Natural Mind retreat, I just thought, this is it. this is what I've been looking for. It's just this wonderful knowing and experience. So Angie told me, you know, a few months later about the Dharma Transmission Program, and that it was 5 years at that point. So she talked about the age limit of 60, and that she had barely, you know, snuck in under the wire. And I just thought, oh my gosh, by the time, if he does offer another one, I won't be able to do it. And I was so disappointed. I mean, just crushed, just disappointed. And then, you know, as causes and conditions go, it turned into 3 years and I did sneak in under the wire. So this, I think the first year was really important for me for building on foundation and things that I didn't know in Buddhism, which was a lot. And I didn't realize how important they were until I was doing them, especially the Noble Truths. It was just a beautiful exploration into that. And the group itself, you know, Fred is a master. So we come in there the first night of the first weekend and we're all in love with each other. You know, we're just given this opportunity to really build group cohesion and it was just a magical experience and has continued to be. So these people, you know, we're family and we support each other. And I think that's really key and important. The second year was, you know, all about, it was certainly Mahayana. We have lots of readings, but really it's about Bodhisattva, about Bodhicitta to me. And then once I got to the third year, the wisdom year, in December, I went to do a 10-day at Empty Cloud. And I knew something was different. And I think during the first year, what I've left out is my life just kind of fell apart. You know, life happens, but what needed to fall apart did fall apart. And a lot of things in my unconscious and my storehouse just came up to the surface. And it was pretty challenging. It's a good word for it. So by the time I make it to the third year, I realized that I have changed, that, you know, trust and faith and belongingness and starting to really get that I'm not a separate self. That was changing. So I go to this 10-day retreat and I realize this change there. I'm working with Gerard Dorji's three statements, if you guys have ever looked at that. And I thought, you know, it feels different this time. It's certainly a practice, but it was more sustainable and there was something more solid. So this solidity that Fred and all of you have helped me with, that just started to build. So then, you know, we come to June and I went to the Wisdom Retreat. I was lucky enough to be one of the people actually at the center, which was magical. But again, it was more of that trust and faith and more of that solidity and, you know, enjoying looking at the clouds from our special little rooms there at Great Cloud. And then I went to the one in September. So each time I've been, you know, just touched by the experience of awareness, of no separation. And it's certainly a practice. I'm not saying that this is happening for Donna all the time, but I am saying that it's different. And I feel like that I can be more helpful. And I truly hope that I can be, but I feel like I can be more helpful. When I first met Fred, we kind of got in alignment with what my aspiration was. And he said, first help yourself before you go out trying to help people. And I'm totally on with that. And that's been my aspiration the whole time. But it feels like I'm closer to doing that at this point. And of course the practice continues. And as we draw to a close, I'm, gosh, you know, so sad and and clingy and graspy with all these people, but I'm also so grateful. We have had an experience, a really intimate experience with Fred, an intimate experience with ourselves or lack of self. Who am I? Really starts to be like, oh, I can figure that out. Or not figure it out. That can come to me. That experience can come to me. So if there's anybody listening and they're thinking, I don't know if I can do this, just do it. Just do it. Just do the Nike thing and do it. I'm going to leave you with a visual. I was kayaking a few months ago, and I'm not a great kayaker at all. So I'm on a river, and I get into this eddy, and I'm just swirling around. And these experienced kayakers came and said, hey, you know, if you do this, I don't even remember what they said. I think it was lean forward. If you do this, you're going to get out of the eddy. And I said, thank you. I think I would have been there forever. And I feel like that's where I was before I met Fred and the Sangha that I was just spinning around. And now I'm going down the river, flowing with all of you and the river.
Thank you, Donna. It's always interesting to hear spontaneous words. Rosie, you want to come up? So this is Rosie. Rosie lives here in Tampa. Rosie's an immigrant from Nepal. Came here at how old?
25.
Came here at 25. So she really is. So she's married, has two children. And this is Rosie. And then Rosie became a member, and then she joined the transmission program. So do you want to, maybe I'll give you 5 to 7 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone.
Why don't you maybe take your mask off? It's a little hard to.
Okay.
Yeah, a little muffled.
Yeah, I moved to Tampa in 2017, and I found FCM at that time. And prior to that, I know. my first doorway to Dharma was Vipassana in my early 20s, and I was definitely suffering as a teenager. Not the suffering that people would see. People would see me as a happy teenager or whatever. At that time, no one could tell, but there was some suffering in me. And I was definitely looking for happiness, and I went to Vipassana, and it was amazing. It helped me. And then later on again, married, have kids, and then life and all the suffering. I went back into that habitual tendency of going in a deep hole and going back to Vipassana, and was really impressed how it wasn't as significant as the first time, but still it helped me to come a little bit up so I can a little bit look. And like Fred said, it was I'll come back to that, but it helped me, but my practice was with me, practicing to make the practice strong and getting my peace in my mind. And it was about, but still that understanding peace and was missing. And then I was still seeking, searching. I went to Rishikesh to do the yoga teacher training, and
that's in India.
Yes, in India, it's a yoga capital of the world, and I went to I got MBSR. I did MBSR. I was really impressed by that mindfulness, being in here, being in now, and implementing that mindfulness, and how important that was. So that was really helping. And I also thought that, wow, this is not enough. I need to be the teacher. So I got the teacher training from UMass, and and I was teaching too, but still that I did see that in me, that my practice and myself inside was like, I used to visualize this tree that I'm trying to help others, but I know that when there is a storm, the roots are not strong enough. And I could feel that, because even when I drew those trees, those were weak trees. So I knew that. And I started taking intensive. Before taking intensive, I didn't know what FCM was totally about, because I thought it was mindfulness, or I don't know, because I went to a lot of temples and different monasteries. So that things that used to attract us to the temple was the food and the bells and the incense. And so I didn't know whether we went to temple for the food or what. So it was like, okay, so where is the food? Where is more food? We can have more food. So still, like, that wasn't like, it was not like, oh, I came inside and stepped into FCM and I felt like, wow, this is the, that didn't happen to me. And yes, Fred's Dharma talk. Fred talked about how he would ask people in one of his Dharma talk, he said, like, he would ask people, how is their life going, like practice going, and how is their life going? And people would be saying that their life is great, like their practice is going great, but their life sucks. And then he said, that's not the real practice. And I was like, wow, that's what I need then. So that's when, and then coming to interview with Fred did help me. He see things better, know things better. So I definitely knew that this is a great teacher, but still, like, I didn't know if it was, he was my teacher. Because coming from Nepal, and I went back to Nepal again, I was thinking I would find even like more great teacher or something, and things didn't happen. I was supposed to go to the top of the mountain, the guards are slide back, and I was like, oh, I couldn't go somewhere. When I went to the monastery, stayed there, the teacher was not there. He was in a European US tour to giving teachings everywhere, but he was not in his monastery. So anyways, so, and then I was like, I had seen this email, and I had this feeling like I wanted to do this program, but still, like, I'm not that old student of Fred that they are asking for, and maybe I'm not fit for this program, so I don't know, but I didn't even have the courage to ask. Then finally, since I was more comfortable with Angie, I talked to Angie, and she said, like, why don't you email? The program had already started, why don't you email Fred? And I emailed Fred, and I think Fred talked to all of the Dharma Transmission group, and I am very, very fortunate, and I feel a deep gratitude from the bottom of my heart, like, Donna just said, it's the best thing possible that had happened to me, and I feel very fortunate, because, like, yeah, there was a lot of fixing of my lenses that was needed, and I was not seeing things in the way I need to see, and Fred's teaching is more about practice, and he is more about how is your life, how is Rosie doing, how is her life, how is her family, how is the, like, it's not about what you read, because I have the tendency of like a different way of learning, but he, like, okay, so how did this affect, like, how is it showing up in your life? So it was very, very deep teaching, and the way he could see through of why I was falling, and it was not something like, oh, you have this, take this and you'll be fine, but he helped me see where I was stuck and what I was not seeing, and helped me see that clearly. And it's amazing, because, like, yesterday Fred was saying, everyone thinks that they are from heaven of Tusita or something. And the problem is somewhere else. So there was definitely that seeing that, wow, I am such a kind-hearted person all my life. I have been trying to do this and this. Have you ever seen in my life, if you go back to the history, have I hurt anyone? Right? So that's where I was. I always saw that way, but I didn't see what I was not seeing clearly. So that definitely helped me be a better mother and wife and friend, because it's not only the teaching and knowing the teaching, being in the program, we get to practice and practice, and having these bi-weekly where we meet with a small group, and we just don't talk about the chapter or what's in there, but we talk about how our life is and how, what have we been able to implement or not implement, what are we having difficulties in. And since we are here together in that call, there is a sense of community, and there is so much of understanding, and in the process there's so much of, I don't even have words. English is not my first language.
You're doing quite fine, but I have to ask you to summary sentence, because
okay. So the summary is like, it's just wow.
Well, thank you, Rosie. And last is Chris. Chris is down in Fort Myers. Chris Lee Nguyen. Am I saying it right? Chris Lee? No? How would you say it? Yeah. Thank you. Well, I'll let Chris say it. So Chris has been with us a good time. He's Chris now is in his 30s. He came to us in his 20s. When he came, he was very much a scientist, very skeptical. I remember old Chris. Very skeptical. And he's married, and he has a new child. That's about, anyhow. So this is Chris from Fort Myers.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me? So prior to the Dharma transmission, I was still pretty active in FCM, doing intensives and retreats. But when the intensive would be posted, it was always, well, let me see what my friends are doing, which one they're taking, which intensive seems more tasty to do, or, you know, I don't really like this topic, or I'm too busy right now. A lot of thoughts like that. And for the last 3 years, I haven't had to really think at all about the path, because I've been on this guided tour by Fred, where Fred has just been taking me along. And there's just a lot of ease and freedom in that alone. I don't have to figure it out. It's, I just show up. It's like showing up for dinner. I don't have to prepare anything. And so Fred has really been taking us on a Dharma tour, showing us all these Dharma doors, opening up his life, his history, his experiences, all the wisdom and insights and practices that he's accumulated over the years. He's just opened his heart and his home and his life to us and been like, here, this is what's been beneficial, transformative to me. And so my relationship with Fred has really grown. And my relationship to all the great teachers of the lineage has grown and deepened as well. And the word that comes to mind is just steeped. I just feel like I've been, for the last 3 years, steeped in the lineage, steeped in the history of the Dharma over the past 2,000 years, because Fred has just been taking us through, not necessarily year by year, but just from the beginning, from the Buddha's enlightenment, and just showing us all the Dharma all the way up to his very life over the last 45, 50 years here. And that to me is amazing. And it's also me opening up to Fred and him really getting to know me more as a person. Prior to Dharma transmission, I could disappear. I could sit in the back row, stay quiet, keep my head down. But in Dharma transmission, it's a small group where you're meeting with your brothers and sisters. You're meeting with Fred on such a basis every other week. And it's just constantly like pouring your heart out, pouring your mind. What's, you know, how is Chris today? How is Chris dealing with what he's studying, what he's learning, what he's practicing with? And so really learning how to open myself up in a way to Fred and to the people in my group. I really didn't, when I went into this, think about how much the relationships and the friendships of the other members in Dharma transmission would be so transformative to me. And over the past 3 years, I've really just opened up in those friendships where they're the people that I rely on, the people I go to, the people that I share, like just intimate details about myself. And I know that they're there for me because we're all just going through this together, practicing, studying the same things. And that's been amazing, as well as my relationship to the Dharma through the teachings, the texts, the practices, just learning how to read the Dharma, how to study the Dharma, how to experiment and just be free with this stuff and not caught up in so much of the conceptualization, so much of the technique, but really just being open to sampling as we go on this tour of all these Dharma doors. And just there's such wonder and splendor in finding all these. He's like taking us on like a backstage pass and like, oh, look over here. We've never seen this before. And if you go over here, look at this. And it's been so just eye-opening to see how big and deep and interconnected the Dharma really is. And he's really given us the freedom to, you know, if you resonate to something, if you find something, you know, keep diving in that direction, keep exploring, experiment. So the word experimentation really has come up a lot for me when I reflect on these 3 years. It's just being immersed, bringing it into my life and experimenting. And I remember at the start, the last Dharma transmission was sharing about their experiences. And they were sharing about how so much of aspects of their life just dropped away. And I remember like not really understanding that. But now 3 years later, there really is so much of my life that was just entertainment for entertainment's sake that has just dropped away, that is just no longer a priority, no longer there. And I just don't even want to pick it up because I'm just so grateful and I'm just so in love with the Dharma. And it's just been a wonderful tour. And I'm just so grateful for all the friends that I've met and come along, and Fred, and all the teachers that have transmitted to Fred and transmitted to them all the way back.
Thank you, Chris. Just full disclosure, I had no idea what anybody was going to say, so it's a little embarrassing to hear them talking about this guy Fred all the time, but I believe in transparency and non-rehearsal, so there it is. And also, please understand, this was not an advertisement for, even though it sounded that way, hearing people's enthusiasm. I mean, it's just, you know, I realize many people, their situation in their life would really prevent them from doing that. And again, please understand that while I certainly am happy to hear the positiveness of these three and the what has got on for them, please understand I also hear that from many members who aren't in the Dharma transmission, who would just, you know, practice seriously, not like seriously, but seriously. I mean, you know, it's that this is just an important part of their life, and, you know, they do what they can, they come to Sangha when they can, they're in intensive workshops. But the most important thing, and I think, you know, Rosie was saying that, and I think that's one of the hallmarks of our community, you know, early on in my Dharma career, I would, you know, everybody, they would talk about their practice. You know, this is my practice. And when they'd meet fellow practitioners, you know, how's your practice going, right? And I realized as I got to know these people that how their practice was going and how their life was going, how their practice was going, how their relationships were going, were like two different worlds, you know. It struck me that that's why, of course, I love Thich Nhat Hanh and Engage Buddhism, that, you know, Buddhist teachings, it's good to study, it's good to practice, but yet, why do we do all that? So we can show up in the world, show up in our relationships, show up at our places of work differently, to be of help, to be that calm, clear person, to be that stable person, to be that compassionate person. And to me, that is the proof of the pudding of practice. You know, people can have wonderful practices, wonderful experiences, wonderful meditations, and then go home and yell at their wife, or, you know what I'm saying? So it's, anyhow, I hope this was inspiring to you. It wasn't meant, again, to be an advertisement for, but just, it's always just, I think, inspiring to listen to ordinary people like ourselves. All those people have careers, they all have families, children, I mean, you know, the full deal. And yet they've been able to find a way to bring, something very meaningful into their life that is not just a hobby, but is something that's very been instrumental in changing themselves and being benefit to others. So this has been a nice weekend. We have another hour or two of retreat, started on Friday night, and then yesterday we had a workshop. Maybe some of you were at on the beginning of new practice Saturday morning, which is quite wonderful. It's all good. Thank you all for coming.